All right, well, it's time for the next interview in the Nintendo World Report book project, and I'm, as usual, Jonathan Metz, and I'm here with Mr. Rob Stevens. Hey, Rob.
Hi there, how you doing?
I'm good. It's been a while since we chatted, although it used to be a fairly common occurrence. And Rob, of course, I don't know what would be the best staff title to associate you with. What do you think of yourself as?
Oh, that's a good question. I was technically senior editor, but I ended up having some involvement in a lot of different aspects of the site not as much design, but there was a little bit of coding I would do. I brought in the original forum software that we were using, and got that it worked out. So I was basically kind of responsible for the forums for a while. Of course, writing a lot of stuff, editing a lot of stuff, you name it. So.
And you did a lot of interviews, attended a lot of press events, and
Oh yeah.
wrote game previews and reviews, and we'll talk about some of that stuff. But for people listening to this and who may not recognize your name, maybe we should start off with that just as kind of a point of reference and just to clear up any confusion. So, you wrote or you participated really just in general at the site under a pseudonym, and maybe you could tell us how that came to be and why that is.
Oh my gosh, and it's kind of relevant now too with everything that's been going on. I'll kind of get into that in a second, but yeah, I wrote under the name Rick Powers, and I don't know where that name came from. I think I just kind of threw a couple of words together and decided that was going to be my name. I can't
Well,
remember exactly.
as I
I think it might
recall
have
it.
been a Simpsons reference at one point too.
Oh, okay. As I recall, it was kind of your wrestling name. It was kind of a pro wrestler sounding thing that you had claimed for yourself.
Yeah, that was probably part of it. Yeah, I'm sure there was a lot of different influences in there, but yeah, I know there was a Simpsons. I think it was Homer Simpson. I think is his what was his secret agent name or something like that? It was like Max Power or something. So
Okay.
yeah, I think that might have been a little bit of it
But I mean, it's a volunteer website,
too.
and in general, we did everything under our own names. We weren't a site concerned with using people's screen names and things like that on a regular basis. So our bylines generally had people's real names, but there were a few people with pseudonyms. And why did you have one?
Well, there was two reasons actually, and both of them kind of happened at the same time and was the reason why I switched out. Actually, when I was before Nintendo World Report, but and Planet GameCube before that, I wrote with Justin at the 64 Source, and if I remember correctly, I think I used my real name there. So there was a confluence of things that kind of all happened at the same time. Part of it was the switch over to Planet GameCube. Part of it was my day job, where I was actually working at a game developer. I thought would be a bit of a conflict of interest. I thought that mentally I could put that conflict of interest aside if I was using kind of a different name, and I wanted to make sure that anything I said that might have been potentially negative about Nintendo didn't end up coming back to my employer and potentially hurting them. So I
Right,
wanted
right.
to insulate them a little bit. But the third piece was, because I did have a little bit of a somewhat negative view about Nintendo and some of their business practices and things like that, I would get an awful lot of negative email and negative messages on the forum, and people being very, very aggressive towards what they thought was, something they cared deeply about. And for some reason with video games, it tends to engender these folks who take it very, very seriously. It becomes a deep part of their lives. And most of that I can kind of, it was just all me. I could kind of blow it off and that sort of thing. But the first time we got a phone call at home and they threatened my wife was when I
No
decided,
kidding.
yeah, that's when I decided, you know what, I need to protect my family. And it just so happened that that was going to be when we were switching over to Planet GameCube, and I'm like, you know what, maybe it's time for Rob Stevens to go away for a little while, and just basically made up a name that they were going to have a harder time tracking down if they decided to do that. So yeah, I was, before it was cool, I was doxxed and
Yeah.
basically people, started calling the house and,
I
well,
did
not
not
people, one
realize that
person.
had happened. I mean, could you
Yeah.
place a time around when that might have been?
Oh my gosh.
I mean, we switched over to Planet GameCube probably around mid-2001, early 2001, before the system
Yeah,
launched?
it would. I was going to say, I know that I was living in our place in Seattle. I was actually in Seattle proper at the time, which is the only time I've lived there. So, yeah, that would be around that time frame. Yeah.
Maybe late 2000 or early 2001.
Yeah.
That's wild.
And the thing is, the internet has always been a place where toxic people can kind of get together and
Oh,
share
yeah.
common viewpoints and things like that. I think we're seeing that to a very extreme right now, just with the political climate and things like that. But we're seeing this a lot in the game industry, where there's a lot of these people that feel like they normally don't have a voice, in their real lives for whatever reason, and they care a lot about video games and what the video games mean to them, and they overreact and lash out in ways that are completely inappropriate. And we're seeing that a lot now, especially with females in the game industry, unfortunately. But yeah,
Right.
basically,
Yeah.
it's a point they disagree with, they tend to lash out at it. It is what it is.
Do you recall the contents of that phone call? I mean, do you remember what specifically this person was angry about or what they said to you?
I don't, because they didn't say it to me. It was my wife that took
It
the
was
phone
to your
call.
wife. Wow.
I should say ex-wife. So
Sure,
yeah.
yeah. That's incredible. Wow. I did not know that that had happened. I mean, I'm surprised to hear it from our community, although, back then our community was very different and certainly was less curated. In some ways was quite a bit larger than it is now. Or at least, I think we were pulling in people at the edges from other communities and maybe just kind of randos from internet searches back then, because there was less to choose from and our site was more prominent among the field. And so sometimes we would hear people who would, and I think actually a lot of the negative type interactions we've had with people over the years, because you're not the only one who's received threats, although it usually happens over Twitter nowadays rather than phone
Yeah,
calls.
exactly.
But a lot of it tends to come from people who don't actually read our site. But people will find something that they consider inflammatory or very disagreeable, and then they'll spread it on other message boards at other sites, in other communities. And somebody will just see that and then will just decide that, we need to be dealt with somehow or what,
Yeah,
So I don't
exactly.
think that thing tends to come from our own community, because I do feel like we've generally maintained a positive atmosphere and a constructive tone. Maybe not always positive, maybe sometimes very pessimistic, but at least constructive tone among the people who tend to interact with us and who read our site. And I'd like to think that the site itself tends to project that kind of attitude.
Well, and back in those early days, though, it was, if you'll remember correctly, I mean, I think the forums came after the 64 source. I'm trying to remember now, but I mean, I was very, very ruthless at shutting down people on the forums
Oh,
who were
sure.
basically trying to goad people into fights, or who were posting misinformation and things like that. I mean, I wanted to make sure that when people were coming to our site, where they would find information that was, first of all, truthful, and second of all, was meant to build the community and not tear it apart. And that's part of the reason why I was so ruthless about that, is because I had already seen the seeds of it kind of growing previously, and I wanted to make sure that that didn't end up being the case at Planet GameCube.
Yeah, I remember that you wrote the rules of conduct for the forums.
The manifesto.
I mean, it was a lengthy document, and you pretty much required that people read it during the registration process. So the idea was that everyone who is posting here is familiar with these rules and is expected to follow them. And I specifically remember there was a line in there that said, these forums belong to our website. You do not have freedom of speech here. If we don't like what you write, we can remove it and you.
Oh, and I got no end of flack for that too, from
Yeah.
people who felt like I was infringing upon their freedom of speech. And again, it was a viewpoint at the time that a lot of people didn't agree with, but it was the fact that you're absolutely free to say anything you want using your own mechanisms. You don't have the right to say whatever you want using somebody else's, right? You can't come into my phone and home and use my phone and use it to call up somebody and slander them, right? You don't have that right. It's the same thing with the internet, right? The place that we give you to have these conversations, and I like to think that we gave people a place where they could have political conversations as long as they were kept productive and things like that, still amounts to, we end up being ultimately responsible for whatever gets said on there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we wanted to make sure that we were keeping things, you know, considerate of others. And, you know, again, truthfulness is a big bugaboo of mine. I wanted to make sure that people weren't just, you know, flat out lying about things and stuff like that. And I was very, very quick to shut people down who were, you know, running afoul of my rules.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, you talk about truthfulness, and of course you were, you know, one of the people on our staff, one of the few who were writing under a fake name, but I certainly feel that, you know, and I've known you for a long time. We've hung out lots of times in Seattle and also at E3. And I feel like you, more than most staff members, really brought your personality through your writing and through your interactions. And you were one of the people who I felt like was most synchronized with your online persona. You know, when I met you in person, it was like, well, yeah, that's Rick. I mean, the things you would say weren't surprising because we, you know, I already kind of knew you from online, and you were just really consistent in that way. And it's something I always admired about a lot of people on our staff, is that, you know, they were interested in being themselves, and the site in a lot of ways was a place where they could be themselves, you know, and that's what they wanted. And anyway, I do feel that you really brought a lot of personality through your writing. And I think when you eventually left the site, I think we really lost a voice there that is irreplaceable, because, you know, you are you. You're very individual, and I can't think of anybody else who's really much like you, Rob.
Well, thanks. You know, it's you know, the irony of, you know, being somebody who wants to be as authentic as possible online using a fake name is not lost on me at all. But, you know, one of the things, I mean, I've been told plenty of times that I write exactly the way I talk. Mm-hmm. Right, to that. And part of that is I write in a very stream of consciousness sort of manner and then go back and edit after the fact. I want to make sure I get all the thoughts down as I'm thinking of them. And I think that part of that process kind of helps my authenticity a little bit, because it's literally whatever's coming out of my brain at the moment. Mm-hmm. I will talk a lot if you get me talking, because again, I talk the same way I write. I just let everything come out, and then, you know, I just don't get as many chances to go back and edit what I'm saying after the fact. But, I really wanted to make sure that if there was part of me that I was not upfront about, that I was as honest and transparent about as much of everything else as I could be. I thought that I kind of owed that to our readership. So mm-hmm. Yeah, that's part of the reason why I tried to do that, is I wanted to let people know more about me, even if they couldn't get past the name necessarily. Everything else was going to be as authentic as it could be.
Well, do you ever hear people calling you Rick Powers anymore?
Just the folks that knew me from back then. Yeah, I haven't used it in a long, long time. it's also not the last pen name that I've had either.
Yeah. I was thinking, I don't know if you want to get into this, but you did some freelance writing both during when you were at PGC, you were doing some writing about other topics, mostly, I think, for IGN. And,
it was. Yep.
And then after that, I mean, after you left the site, did you continue writing, you know, as a hobby or professionally, or?
A little bit, yeah. So I did a little bit of freelance for IGN under the name Lee Stewart. And again, part of that was to isolate what I was talking about from my employer. I think at the time I was working for AT&T Wireless, and I had a lot of knowledge into the mobile arena. Mm-hmm. So I ended up doing some writing for them in the mobile space, you know, specifically on mobile gaming and things like that. Mm-hmm. And then, I mean, after that, I've written for Gear Live, one of my friends out here, Andrew Edwards, who runs that site. I did a little bit of freelance work for him as well. And that was all under my actual name, because, you know, there wasn't a whole lot I needed to worry about when it came to writing about, you know, tech topics. Those folks tend to... I mean, it was, again, it was just reviews of stuff and you know, did a little bit of, I think a couple of game reviews for them, but, you know, nothing nearly as incendiary, maybe, as some of the things I had written about previously. So.
Yeah, I think you were probably, you know, like I said, you really brought a lot of personality to your writing, and I think maybe there was a disinterest in neutrality that was uncommon back in the early 2000s. And that some people were very uncomfortable with. I think the style of writing that you were doing back then is much more common now. And maybe people are, you know, if not more okay with it now, at least more accustomed to it. You know, I think it's much more commonplace.
I think I've probably said this to you before, but we were a blog before blogs were a thing.
Right.
Yeah, before, and when I say blog, I don't mean necessarily, you know, somebody's own personal kind of online diary, like a lot of blogs were at the time.
Yeah, more but like we, Huffington Post or something like that, or, you know,
or like a
Kotaku.
Exactly. That's exactly what I was going to say, is we were a lot more like that style of a blog, where you have many voices, but they're all distinctly somebody's voice, than, you know, a lot of other sites like IGN and stuff like that, where it was all kind of a homogenized sort of voice. Yeah, there was a lot of different writers, but the styles were all very much the same. I don't know, you know, on the inside if that's because they had any sort of a specific style guide or anything like that. I doubt it. But I think it was just maybe everybody's, the people they would tend to hire would tend to gravitate towards that same voice. I don't know.
Well, and I think they did. I think IGN in particular had a lot of editorial policies that kind of smeared over people's personal viewpoints and styles quite a bit. I mean, they had unsigned game reviews for a long time. They would just say IGN staff.
Yeah, I've been wondering for a long time if that was because of, you know, some of the feedback they would get from people. I'm using feedback in air quotes, by the way.
Yeah, sure.
But if it was because of that, or, you know, some sort of other policy that they had, I'm not entirely sure, but yeah.
Yeah, well, let's rewind a lot
sure.
back to, you know, when you were first, you know, involved with 64Source back in the early days. Do you remember, we've heard a lot about 64Source from Justin already and from Max. So I was wondering if you could maybe focus on the transition over to Planet in 2000. Did you come along with Justin's crew and with his website when that stuff kind of, you know, when he shifted over to Operation in 2000 and then that site eventually merged, is that when you got involved?
I'd been with the 64Source a little bit before that. So I'd had a few things I'd written before that happened. You know, like I said, enough that people had started to identify me with some of the things I'd been writing. But, yeah, I came over as part of that crew, when they merged with Billy's, Planet N 2000 site. I'm trying to remember the exact circumstances behind it. I think Justin, you know, I think he wanted to focus a little bit more on his family and wanted to be a little bit less in the operational space and really wanted to kind of get into some of the web coding that he was doing that he was really happy with and stuff like that. So,
Do you remember how you felt about this idea of merging? I mean, it's kind of an odd concept, I think, to take two relatively large, you know, website operations that do basically competitors, you know, they're doing similar material and just mash all of the content and the staff together.
Yeah, I don't necessarily recall how I felt about it then. I mean, at least now I'd say that, you know, I felt it was going to be a good thing. If we were going to survive as a thing and get the sort of access that we needed to do the sort of writing that we wanted to do, I think it was going to be very important for us to be bigger. I think we were going to need to be a bigger voice. We were going to need somebody who was going to be able to kind of power through it and get us seen and have the political clout with a lot of these companies to be able to get us in where we wanted to be. So,
That's an interesting point, because I think you're absolutely right that it, you know, having a lot of people and having the best writers and having us, you know, work together and build things together, I think that did help increase the clout and give us more access and bring a little bit more stability also to the sites. But it's funny that we all, I think, looking back, see all that as a very positive thing. And then yet all the opportunities that we had later to then go on and merge with other sites and sort of do that yet again and sort of take it to the next level, we turn those down very consistently. Do you recall some of those opportunities?
Trying to remember, and this may be a part that you will want to edit out later. I'm trying to remember if we had gotten an offer from IGN.
Well, we were an affiliate, so we were we had an actual business relationship with them where they were, you know, we would basically, what would happen is every week we would have a few articles that we would submit to their sort of best of the affiliates sort of portal. They had a tool where we would choose articles and submit to them and say, we think your wider audience would find this very interesting. And then they would choose things from those submissions and occasionally run one. So, you know, we had a number of things, but That was, I believe, a relatively expensive program for them where they didn't see a lot of return on it, so it didn't last very long.
Well, and I was trying to remember, I know that there had been talk of us getting acquired at one point, and I'm trying to remember if it was IGN or maybe it was not
Cloud Chaser.
GameSpot. Yeah, that's right.
There
That's
was some Cloud Chaser stuff, and then I think it was when Dave Rushton from Sapphire was in the process of
Oh,
acquiring
yeah.
Cloud Chaser from John Benjamin, and I don't know if that ever happened or not, but we were hearing about it, and so that it was all wrapped up into that. And then there was also a time, and you might not have been with us by that time, but this would have been around 04 and 05 when we were being approached by UGO.
Yes, I was definitely around. Yeah.
Okay, good,
So,
good,
I,
good.
and th this is the thing is, I remember that there were definitely times in our history where opportunities had come around and none of them really panned out for one reason or another, right? There was always some reason why something wasn't going to work. Unfortunately, and this is, probably one of the only places where I really felt kind of negatively about my experience, but I didn't feel like I had a lot of input into any of those decisions or processes or anything like that that I felt, might have been useful. And that's just because, I mean, if you've, I don't know if you've talked to Bill yet
No,
or
not yet.
even be able to.
I'm saving it for the
Yeah.
end.
Yeah. So, Billy and I, butted heads because I had very definite ideas of where I wanted to kind of see things go. And so did Billy. We are both two very strong personalities. And for the most part, I think we got along pretty well. But there was things like when it came to control of the site that, obviously the buck stops with Billy. He was the one bankrolling everything. So it was important that be the case. And I didn't necessarily always feel like my input was, I will say valued or desired or there's a lot of different words that I could probably use there. And that was frustrating at times.
Do you
But yeah,
think
there was a
that
lot of
was still the case when I was director?
No, not at all.
Okay.
Actually, I thought you and I kind of worked really well together, and
Yeah, that's my memory of it too, is that we
yeah.
were a pretty strong team.
Well, and I think the that kind of when you had your sabbatical in Russia, I like to call it a sabbatical.
Yes, I want to talk about that for
Yeah,
sure.
you were away for a while, and I was able to step in there and kind of keep things humming along. And nobody even really knew it. None of the readers really were aware that you were even gone, other than the fact that maybe you didn't have any new writing go up in that period of time. Maybe you had a
Right.
couple things that got submitted.
I think I might have even like prepared a couple of things to hold
Oh yeah,
back
that's right.
and
That's right.
roll out so that people would be none the wiser.
Yeah.
So yeah, we should talk about that episode, because it's when I think of you, it's one of my happiest memories actually. Was this was okay, so to set the stage, this was 2003, and that spring, I think it was around April, that Billy left the site. And he had been our, director. And before that, I think he was the editor in chief. And then Max took that, and Billy kind of, the idea was that Billy would step back and sort of be more hands off. But by early 2003, he'd had to step back in quite a bit because of some problems that Max was having, and some,
Yeah.
those guys were not on good terms at that point, as most of the listeners will have already heard about from one side. And so, I think Billy had to. Had stepped back in pretty heavily at that point, running the show, but also he had gotten this opportunity to go work at Game Informer, and it was a local thing for him. I mean, he was already living in Minneapolis, and so it was really kind of a perfect opportunity for him, and he was starting their online presence. And so anyway, we were all very happy for him, but also terrified of what was going to happen to our website now that our leader was stepping away, and at least could not formally be participating at all. He was still involved very deep behind the scenes, really just kind of running the money and stuff like that, but was not involved in any kind of day-to-day operations or very much of the planning for what we were doing. And so Billy asked me to take over, and I thought it was a strange choice, I'll say. I really wasn't all that comfortable with him choosing me, but it was one of those things, when you're called upon to do something like that and you have reservations, you should express those and but also respect, you know, I respected his decision, and I thought he probably had reasons for what he was doing. And I just remember thinking, wouldn't Rick be the more obvious choice here? Because you were, you know, older than me, more experienced than me. You were already involved at least as much as I was, if not more, at that point with the site. And it just made way more sense to me that he would ask you to do it. I mean, do you what do you think about all that? What were you getting from him at that time?
Yeah, that's an interesting topic. I'd say that first of all, I was surprised too. So let's start it that way. Yeah. I was every bit as surprised when he decided he was going to pick you to kind of run the site, that he didn't pick me. And again, I think this is largely due to kind of our differences in philosophy about the direction of the site, and where he really wanted to see it go. I think he felt, and again, you'll get his input on this, and I'm sure there's probably differences in our viewpoints here, but I believe he felt that you were going to be the person that would see things through the way he would have wanted them, versus trying to make it his own thing. I mean, if I had taken it over, there are definite changes I would make. I would have been pretty aggressive about it.
Yeah. You know?
I would have turned it into what I would have wanted to see it be. So yeah, I mean, I'd say on that standpoint, I'm not as surprised that he picked you based on what he wanted the site to be, that he wanted to make sure that he had somebody who would respect his vision for it and kind of do that. I'm pretty sure he would say that, you know, I would not have been that person. I would have been great for the vision I had for the site, I think.
Yeah.
Because I was very dedicated to it, and, you know, as evidenced by the fact that I'd even stuck around after that. But
yeah.
You know, I definitely would not have been the person that would have seen Billy's vision through necessarily.
Yeah, that jives with kind of my distant memories of what all was going on around that time. But it, you know, it put me in an awkward spot. I was very concerned about you leaving, you know, but it seemed like a slight against you. And, I think, you know, anybody on the staff probably could have seen that. So, you know, I was pretty interested in keeping you around, and, you know, certainly, you know, I consider you a great friend, and I still do. And so I didn't want to lose you in that sense. I didn't want you to walk away angry, but also didn't want to lose you as an asset to the staff. So I was also in this, awkward position of being asked to do this, which I considered essentially a full-time job on top of being a full-time college student.
Oh, it really was, yeah.
Back then, I mean, really, it still is pretty much a full-time job, even for Neil doing it now. But, you know, I was very worried about doing this while I had already committed to a study abroad program that summer in 2003 to go to Russia for 2 months, where I had no expectation of internet access. I didn't know what I'd be able to do over there. And so, you know, that makes it kind of hard to run a website. Also, wouldn't really be available by phone because I had to buy long distance cards, and I was 12 or 13 hours offset in time zones from most of the staff in the United States. I mean, we had a few people internationally, but certainly the majority was in the US. And so I guess I also saw it as an opportunity, Rob, to let you, you know, have a sense of ownership over what was going to happen. I kind of made you the COO of the website while I was gone. And I told everybody on staff, look, I don't want to make a big deal out of this. I don't want the listeners to feel like Billy just handed it to this kid and now he's leaving for the whole summer and he's not even going to be around. And, you know, I definitely had this palpable sense of the website could fall apart and it could happen on my watch and I would be an asshole if that happened. So you were there and you were able to keep it going, and we kept it very hush hush. I mean, we weren't telling the developers and the publishers we were working with either. And so what was that like for you to be kind of running the show and really getting only a few messages from me over email every week or two when I was able to go to an internet cafe?
Well, you know, first of all, I want to say that, you know, I've always respected you a lot, and there were a lot of times where you would kind of be the mediator between Billy and I, especially on our E3 trips and things like that. You know, you were kind of the guy that bridged the gap between us a little bit, which I thought was great. And more than anything, I wanted to make sure that you know, I loved the site a lot, and I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, Billy and I would occasionally butt heads, is because I felt very passionately about it. It was something that I felt like, not necessarily belonged to me, but I belonged to, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So, you know, obviously, I was a little hurt when Billy decided to let you run the show. But at the same time, when, you know, I didn't want to let you down at all, and I knew that having continuity with the site was going to be very important for its longevity. And then when you said you were going to be heading off to Russia, the last thing I wanted to do was to have it reflect negatively on you. And I think there was also a piece of me that wanted to prove that I could have done it.
Right.
You know, and done it specifically Billy's way, because I know your way was Billy's way, you know. So for me,
certainly
to be able
at that time it would have been.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. So for me to be able to kind of step in there and do all those things, you know, I felt honored about it. It was definitely tough. I mean, it was, you know, a little on the stressful side. But I think that, you know, anybody who was around at that time would say that, you know, things went incredibly smoothly. I can't even remember anything that didn't happened the way it was supposed to.
I remember one thing. I don't. Maybe this will ring a bell for you.
Okay.
But
yeah.
I think it was while I was in Russia, and I was getting a little stressed out about some emails that I had from you guys involving Capcom threatening to basically blackball us or blacklist us over the fact that we were publishing import reviews of their games.
The import debacle.
Yeah.
Oh. Gosh.
Yeah, there was stuff coming, and there weren't even that many import games that they were releasing at the time. The one that might have actually triggered this was, I think, that Mega Man Battle Network Transmission GameCube game. Do you remember that?
I think it might have been that one. I want to say, was there, I'm trying to remember.
Or it was around that time. Maybe that was the first one affected by this, but it was weird.
Yeah. It was, well, and again, this is one of those situations where I kind of alluded to this earlier, but being able to get access to games and access into companies to be able to get information and things like that, that's pretty much the lifeblood of one of these things. Everybody's got a freaking opinion, right? I mean, that's not unusual. You know, half the job is being able to write your opinion in a way that's compelling that people want to read. But the other half of it is being able to have access to be able to get the information to help round out those opinions, you know, to be able to get news before it's, you know, comes out in a press release, things like that.
Right.
So not having access into companies could easily kill a site like ours. And I think that, you know, we had done enough kind of investigating and established enough contacts in the industry that's what kind of kept us around for as long as we had been. You kind of live and die on that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, when, you know, we were trying to cover Capcom's stuff better, and, you know, doing import reviews was one of those things that we were looking at, because we had all hacked our GameCubes, you right. know, right? Because it was so easy to do it.
And you didn't have to on the GBA.
Right, on the GBA you didn't have to, but on the GameCube, it was simply as simple as literally soldering in a switch. That's literally all you had to do. I had the company I was working for at the time. We had, you know, guys in there that could do all that stuff. We had all the equipment to do it. So it was super, super easy to have that done. So being able to publish, you know, impressions, and I don't think we ever called them reviews at the time, but I think we called them impressions of these games, became pretty important, because we felt like it was an early look at what would hopefully eventually be coming stateside for people to be able to be more informed about.
Right.
You know, I felt that was kind of a, not even a, you know, necessarily the responsible thing to do, but I felt like we had a duty to make sure that we were getting early enough information about these things as possible. And quite frankly, I mean, it was a finished product. It wasn't finished for our region, but it was finished where it was released. So I didn't even think there was anything, you know, below board about it.
Yeah. And this was back in an era that some people may have a hard time relating to now, but this was before you could really get video on the internet. So there was no YouTube, there was no way to watch trailers of things or Let's Plays or anything like that. And so usually the only information you had about a game from another country like Japan was maybe some screenshots that had been published in a magazine and maybe a few sentences if they, you know, had the wherewithal to actually get a copy and play it. So we were doing something that was done at the print publications all the time. And in large part because they had these very long lead times, so they needed to be able to play import stuff and then just sort of validate it against a translation, you know, before the local release, just to say, okay, yeah, they changed this and this, but most of it's the same. So
right.
The stuff we wrote is still good enough. Now we can jump to print and make our deadlines. We didn't have those deadlines. And so we were actually running at the time full length, fully scored, 100% complete reviews of these games that were in some cases not coming to America, Europe, etc. for another 6 months or more.
Or and sometimes at all. I mean, for
occasionally,
various reasons,
yeah.
Sometimes there would be a game that would just never come out in the US.
It was right. So anyway,
whatever. So yeah.
I just recall that the solution, which I thought was absurd, but the solution to our problem with Capcom is that they were really hung up on the fact that it was a review with a score. And so if we took away the score and called it anything but a review, they didn't really care. And so we just changed them to full-length impressions. And
yep.
We literally just took the score off and wrote and just ran the same review as just a hands-on impressions article, basically. And they were okay with that. And so we did that, but we only did it with that one publisher for like 2 or 3 years until their policy eventually changed and they stopped caring.
Yeah, and I couldn't remember where the impressions thing came in. I couldn't remember
but that's,
that was
it was the solution,
the compromise or whatever. But mm-hmm. You know, I think it's important to note that again, this was early enough in the process where blogs weren't even really a thing yet. So really, mm-hmm. people just saw us as this you know, fan site. I think that's the tag we got from a lot of these different publishers, and we weren't necessarily taken seriously by a lot of them. And
right.
I think as word got around and we established these relationships, that started to fade a little bit. Plus the whole nature of the internet was shifting at this time too. And things were always moving pretty fast. But for us to be able to, you know, to have access to these things at all was really important. And that's what, you know, one of the reasons why wanted to make that compromise. But we would run into little issues like this with publishers all the time where they were just, you know, they wanted to have more control over what we were saying than they would necessarily a bigger organization like an IGN or something like that, where they wouldn't try to wield that same power because they know they needed those sites. They weren't yet understanding that with our position and the sorts of people that would read our stuff, that it was more of a kind of word of mouth marketing sort of opportunity for them. And they hadn't
yeah.
really come around to that viewpoint yet. They do now. Now they understand these things. And now companies are reaching out directly to all, you know, sorts of fan sites and blogs, trying to get them because they understand the power of that word of mouth. But
mm-hmm.
for us at the time, it was really kind of an uphill slog.
Right. Yeah. So, I'm curious, you know, you know, once I got back from Russia and I was, you know, able to run the site day to day from that point forward for the next few years, I think by the time I handed the directorship over to someone else, which is a story for another day, I believe you were probably not on the site anymore. So, you know, a lot of your tenure there was sort of, you know, before that summer and after that summer. You know, would you compare the two? I mean, I would certainly like to think that when I was director, I was seeking your guidance and we worked together to kind of figure out how we wanted to do a lot of things. And I would consider you absolutely one of the highest level leaders in the organization and someone who really had a lot of direct input into what we did and how we did it. Do you feel that same way, and how do you feel like the site changed during that period when you were able to you know, contribute in that way?
So I was really happy with it, and when I did eventually leave, it had nothing to do with being unhappy. It was simply a matter of bandwidth and that sort of thing. There just wasn't just a lot that I was able to do, you know, time wise, and I wanted to make sure that I was, you know, putting my time where it was going to be most needed. And, you know, at that point it was just, you know, it was the extra things had to kind of, you know, take a back seat. So,
right.
It had nothing to do with that, but yeah, I really loved, the site a lot. I think that it, definitely flourished under your leadership for sure. And you know, I mean, just the fact that it's, you know, sticking around today under a, you know, a completely new name and is still a, you know, it sounds dumb to say force on the internet, but that it still has some level of influence.
Yeah.
Is very heartening to me. I don't read it as often as I'd like to, mainly because I haven't had a Nintendo console in a very long time. But every once in a while I do kind of come back and check things and see how stuff is going, and it's really amazing to see that it's stuck around in some permutation for as long as it has. It's really amazing.
I'm curious about your shift away from Nintendo. I would imagine that is also related to leaving the site and just, you know, your life and your taste changing over time. I also know that, you know, you were a very big fan of a lot of Nintendo's major franchises. I mean, you gave 10s to Zelda Wind Waker and Metroid Prime, and I remember your coverage of Eternal Darkness was a really big influence on me and got me way more interested in that game. I'd been following it for a long time, but you were one of the first people I knew who played the final version of it, and you were doing interviews with Dennis Dyack back then. That was an interesting opportunity. I wonder, I think you probably feel the same way, but I'd love to hear you talk about it. But Dennis was kind of, back then, a channel through which we could kind of access Nintendo from a Western sensibility. You know, he was this Canadian guy making Nintendo games all of a sudden, and he seemed just as surprised by it as we were. And also, he didn't seem to have gotten the memo on all the rules that go with that, and he really just kind of spoke very freely about a lot of that stuff and about game development in general, which is just something that Nintendo does not do and has never done and probably will never do. What did you think about interacting with someone like that back then and with other developers, especially coming from, you know, some background as a developer yourself?
So first of all, I thought it was amazing, and I really, really appreciated the fact that I was the one that got to do what was really a really huge interview with him at the time. And I think some of that had to do with proximity, because the event that took place at was here in Seattle, so I was able to get out there and do that easily. And I think I'm trying to remember all the details. I think we actually had to convince Nintendo to let us do that by basically saying, look, he's already there, he's local, he can just show up and be part of this event, but you don't have to pay to fly him out, you don't have to pay to put him up at a hotel. Look, it's extra coverage for you, and you don't have to pay a dime. I'm trying to remember if that's kind of how that pitch ended up going.
Sure. The fact that we had staff stationed around the U.S., it did allow us to kind of get into some events in that way where we would just kind of, you know, we would tell the publisher, hey, this doesn't really cost you anything extra to just let this person in, and we have a large audience, so you really don't have anything to lose. I think that did play out well for you. So I'm specifically talking about, or you're talking about this interview from the Gamers Summit, which is probably a Nintendo event back in April of 2002. Was this at their headquarters in Redmond?
It wasn't. It was, well, actually part of it was. So part of it was in Redmond. Mm-hmm. Part of it was at a place they went in Seattle. I want to say it was the Big Picture. That may or may not be right. I think it was. Which was basically kind of an oldish movie theater that had been converted into kind of part meeting space, part bar, and part kind of private movie theater. Hmm. It was kind of a multi-day event, but the big part of it was us being able to get down there and get some hands-on time with Eternal Darkness, get some FaceTime with Dennis and talk to him and that sort of thing. So yeah, it was really kind of a cool event.
Yeah,
it's one of the neater ones I've been to, actually.
It's a 4-page interview transcript on the site I'm looking at right now. So quite a lengthy interview you got with him.
Yeah, and I think this was one of those places where, again, I felt kind of a responsibility to take the most of the opportunity. We were able to get ourselves in there through, you know, not an insignificant amount of convincing. So I wanted to make sure that if we were going to do it, we were going to do it right. We were going to prove that we deserved to be there. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it's a little egotistical to say, I think that ended up opening a lot of doors for us down the road with Nintendo by treating it in such a professional manner. But, I'd like to think that it did.
Yeah, I'm sure that it did. I mean, I personally got to visit Nintendo headquarters in Redmond twice as director of the site. It was actually later, let's see, no, it would have been 2004. And I don't remember the other time, maybe 2005.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm sure the work you did at this particular event kind of helped make that happen later on. And I remember part of the my favorite thing about those trips was getting to meet up with you and get to hang out a little bit up in Seattle. Those are the first times I'd ever been there.
Yeah.
Actually, another event I'd love to reminisce about. This isn't even in my notes, Rob, but the time that we went to New York to see WrestleMania.
Oh my gosh.
We were sharing that hotel in at the W in Times Square.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. So if I remember correctly, they had invited you to go. I had done the previous two THQ WrestleMania events that they had done. And I'm not sure why they picked you, but you really wanted to go to New York.
Absolutely. And I did not care about WrestleMania at all.
Exactly. So you didn't care about wrestling. I really wanted to go do the wrestling, and I think we had actually tried to convince them to like have the at least try to get us into separate hotel rooms. We weren't able to work that out. So we're like, look, we'll sleep in the same room together. That's fine. Rick will pay for his own. I'm already using third person again. Weird. So Rick will pay for his own airfare down. And then if we can just let him into the event and to cover all that stuff, it basically ends up turning into a kind of a cool trip for you. And I get to cover the sort of stuff that I cared about. And I thought it was kind of win-win.
Yeah, you got to watch WrestleMania from the press box, I
Yeah,
guess.
it was actually that one was my third WrestleMania in a row. So I had done WrestleMania 19, which was out here in Seattle. And then they flew me to LA for WrestleMania 19. No, pardon me. Yeah, it was 19, I think. No, 19 was in Seattle. 20 was in LA. 21 was in New York. Maybe it was the other way around. Maybe 20 was New York and 21 was LA. I'm trying to remember. Oh my gosh, all that time is so fuzzy.
Yeah, this was all THQ was promoting their WWE wrestling game Day of Reckoning for GameCube, which turned out to be not that great. They made a couple of them, but I'm sure you were the reviewer, but I remember thinking, and I played the demo that they had at the hotel, even though I wasn't going to WrestleMania, and yeah, I just didn't think, compared to the classic N64 wrestling games, I really didn't think it was that much fun to play.
Yeah, so they really had this difficult period where every time they would switch hardware, they'd have to kind of build a new engine from scratch. And a lot of times they would focus on getting some basic stuff done and maybe add a couple of features that were new, but they wouldn't necessarily always include the features that were the ones that people were expecting. So they were constantly running into the situation where I guess in software we kind of call it refactoring, where they build the same software on a new base, and then they end up having to, not put in some features that people were expecting, and they add other ones that nobody asked for, and then people are like, "What's wrong with this company? They not have their act together. How can they not know how important this thing is?" It had nothing to do with that. It just had to do with it being a completely new code base. So yeah, it was kind of funny to watch the way that people would react to that stuff. But eventually, I mean, when it comes right down to it, everybody's a consumer. Everybody buys a game. They have expectations, fair or not, when they come into buying that game. And that's kind of the interesting, this complete digression, but it's kind of the interesting place where we are, where when video games are treated as both an art form and a consumer product, whether or not people's impressions and the way they interpret that art are fair, and if they're even more fair when it's something that they had to pay money for, and that sort of thing too. It's really interesting.
Right, yeah, there's an investment, a personal investment that comes with the economic investment you make in a game, and there's a lot of interesting discussions to be had over, for instance, with game reviews. If you get a free copy of the game, does that positively or negatively impact your feelings about it? Because you really don't owe the game anything because you didn't pay for it, but you might be concerned about the relationship with the publisher by which you got that free copy. And and also you may be less inclined to give the game a pass for creative decisions or just things you don't like about it, because you didn't have to pay for it, so you're not really trying to justify a purchase. So anyway, that's a much longer thing, but
It
I
is, yeah.
think some of the points you just made actually kind of lead me to a different topic, which is that you approached criticism of video games from a perspective of actually understanding some of what goes on inside a game studio. And I was wondering if you could talk about those experiences that you had.
Yeah, absolutely. So it was part of my tenure there. I was also working for a game developer in Redmond called Boss Game Studios. Mm-hmm. They had made a racing game for the Nintendo 64 called World Driver Championship.
It was very popular, or at least very critically popular, at least.
Yeah, it was. It was kind of trying to be the Nintendo's version of Gran Turismo, and I think on a lot of levels it succeeded. Not all of them, but you know, for what it was able to do, it was pretty neat. What was amazing to me is that I was working for this developer. It was part of it. I'd actually done an interview with them, and apparently I had done a good enough job doing that interview that they said, "Hey, you know, if you're ever looking for work, you know, come talk to us. We might have, you know, a place for you here."
No kidding. That has never happened to me a single time.
Yeah.
In all my years of doing this stuff, I've never been solicited for a job out of a you know, doing this stuff.
Yeah, and I wasn't sure how serious Colin was about that. Colin Gordon, who was the, I believe the, not the president, but he was, well, maybe he was the president, because I know he wasn't the CEO, but he was the president of the company. Had, you know, we ended up having a great friendship, both during and after I had worked there. I consider him a mentor of mine professionally. We've had a lot of really great talks, but I think it was just something about the way that I, you know, comported myself during that interview, made him want to make that offer. I wasn't sure how serious he was being about it. And I think it was quite a few months later before I actually, you know, reached out to him and said, "Hey, are you serious at all about this? Because, you know, I may be looking to make a change."
Hmm.
And sure enough, they did. I you know, had enough skills in web development and IT and that sort of thing where I was able to get myself a job as, I think my technical title at the time was MIS assistant.
Management of information systems?
Yes. So okay. I reported to the head of MIS. But really I ended up being kind of the jack of all trades in there. So I, helped rebuild the website. I got our, you know, kind of web forums there up and running. Cause again, I had some experience in doing that for Planet GameCube. You know, ended up, being a kind of a community manager role really when it comes right down to it.
You wrote the game manuals, didn't you?
I wrote some of the game manuals. I even continued doing that after, Boss Game Studios had closed down. I ended up doing that freelance for Colin when Colin was at, I'm trying to remember who it was. Who was the publisher for Daisen Raku 7? If I go in my drawer here, I probably.
What was it?
It's a game called Daisen Raku 7.
I've never heard of it.
Kemco, there we go.
Ah.
So, yeah, Colin went to go work for Kemco, and he had brought me in to do a little bit of freelance work for him. So I basically translated the Japanese manual over to English and had provided that for them.
I didn't know you knew Japanese.
I don't. They had given me that Japanese translation. And I, you know, basically with both Google and just, you know, decent skills in English, managed to complete that translation and kind of get it over to him for that. So,
okay.
So I had done that. And I'd actually done a little bit of consulting for him as well, which was the weirdest thing I think I've ever done. He brought me in to take a look at a game that they were considering publishing and wanted my take on it as to whether or not it was going to be something well received by the public. And I don't even know how free I am to talk about some of that because it may be, I won't mention the name.
Sure.
I'll say that it was based on a, on another IP, that had been in the, television/movie space. Right. So it had been an entertainment property that they were adapting into a game. And basically what I came down to, I think I had gotten my degree at Cascadia Community College at the time. And I'd also gotten a game design certificate. I'd taken some game design classes from actually one of the guys that worked on Halo, Hardy LaBelle. He had taught that class. And one of the things he taught us in that class was that, you know, whenever you're adapting an IP or really any sort of property that people are familiar with, you need to take special care to make sure that the things that people would expect out of that are included, because otherwise they'll reject it out of hand, even if it's a great game. And that was kind of the, so like, for example, I think in the class, what he had used was the idea of pirates, right? So pirates have, you know, certain mannerisms, they have certain things that they say, things like that. And if those things aren't included in the property you're adapting, people won't see it as being a pirate's thing. They'll see it as this other thing being called pirates, and they're not going to like it, right? So that was basically the kind of the approach I took with this. And I said, you know, I'm familiar with the property you're basing this game on. From what I know of it, people are going to expect, you know, certain things. And if you're not able to bring those things into the game, either because of licensing reasons or whatever the case is, I think you're going to have a hard, you know, a hard time with it. You'd be better off calling it something else than calling it what it's supposed to be called. And ultimately, they ended up taking a pass on that game. And I don't know if it's because of that feedback or because of other things that were going on. I think they were trying to get some of the additional licensing agreements in place to be able to make it more authentic, and weren't able to do it for whatever reason, either cost or lawyers or, you know, whatever the case is. There's a lot that goes into, you know, making a game, but yeah. So anyway, I'm bouncing around the topic like a crazy.
No, it's great. I'm really interested to hear this stuff. And I'm curious also, did Colin know that you were working for PGC while you were working for him?
He did not.
Ooh. Did that ever come up? I mean, did you ever discuss it with him later?
It did. I think I did after the fact. Oh, no. Pardon me. Colin did know. Yeah, he did know. I had told him about that, and I told him, I said, by the way, I'm using a pseudonym, so there shouldn't be any concern about anything that happens coming back to you guys or anything like that. And if I remember correctly, he was okay with it. But that did lead into probably the most important sort of journalistic scoop that I ever got. There was two of them that really kind of, well, three if you count the Stiak interview. There's probably three that stick out in my most.
I can't wait.
The most important work I did, but this one was, we had gone to Nintendo. He had brought me with him to go into a meeting to basically talk about what kind of what was going on with World Driver Championship and that sort of thing, and getting it ready for release. So basically, it was an acceptance meeting or something like that. So I got to sit in on there, and the person we were talking to had, you know, was just kind of shooting the breeze as we were coming out of the meeting, and asked Colin if we were going to be adapting the game for, or doing anything for Project Dolphin. And, you know, we just, again, you know, we're just kind of shooting the breeze coming out, but, you know, we came outside and got in the car, and he goes, did you hear what he said? And I said, yeah, I did. and it turned out, after I'd done a little bit of research and had called a couple people, that Project Dolphin was the code name for what was going to be Nintendo's next console, or the GameCube at that point.
So this wasn't common public knowledge at the time?
It was not.
Oh boy.
I think only a handful of developers had received any documentation or anything about it. It didn't have a name yet. Other than Nintendo internally, not very many people. It was only like maybe the top AAA developers that knew anything about it. So when that person asked Colin about it, he was really letting, you know, privileged information pass. And I don't think he even realized he did it, because he wasn't sure who was in the loop and who wasn't. But you say something like that, and it doesn't necessarily mean anything to anybody who's not already in the loop. But I knew enough to get in the loop quick.
So what did you do with that information?
I sent a couple phone calls, or sent a couple emails, made a couple phone calls, talked to a few of the people that I knew in that community, and say, hey, have you heard anything about this sort of thing? And one of them got back to me and said, that's Nintendo's next console that they're talking about there. I went back and was, you know, able to kind of touch base with a couple more people, give them a little bit more information. And a second one was able to corroborate for me that was in fact Nintendo's next console. And once I had two people telling me the same information, I went ahead and ran with it.
So this would have been a story on probably the 64 source.
No, it was on Planet N 2000 because we knew there was a new console coming. We didn't know what it was called yet.
Interesting. Yep. I might even be able to find that then.
Yeah, it's probably out there someplace. But that was my claim to fame, as I was, out of everybody, all of these different websites, including some pretty major competitors, we were the first ones to break that name, I can't remember. I think we might have even been second to figure out it was going to be called GameCube. But yeah, Project Dolphin, that was the big one.
Yeah, that's awesome. So, did you mentioned going to Cascadia and getting a certificate in game development or game design? Did you end up ever using that? I mean, were you able to get any kind of industry job where you were doing game design?
You know, I didn't. I really wanted to kind of get back into the industry, and I tried. I had a few interviews at a few places. I was actually pretty close to getting a job at Valve at one point. And you know, it's kind of interesting because Valve has really turned into a software as a service company, really, rather than a you know, pure game developer anymore. But yeah, it's just for whatever reason, I really wasn't able to get back in there. And you know, having a family you need to provide for, you know, it's really, you know, taking whatever jobs can come your way. So ended up just, I'm trying to remember. I think I ended up writing for the school newspaper for a while at University of Washington. And then ended up getting a couple more jobs in customer service and just kind of kept going from there. So other than the little over a year that I was at Boss Game Studios, I have never really had a job in the industry proper. I should say I was the second choice for a job writing for Nintendo Power.
Hey.
This was a few years before they closed down the publication, maybe a couple years. So I'm kind of glad in retrospect I didn't, but yeah, it was, I was that close to kind of working for Nintendo. But it doesn't surprise me that the one guy that ended up working for Nintendo did. So I found out that I didn't get the job, and I really kind of chalk it up to a confluence of things. They had a power outage at Nintendo that day, and we ended up having to do the interview, up on the roof. Not on the roof, but out on this terrace outside of Cafe Mario. Yeah. And of course they had all the generators going, trying to keep some stuff up and running. So it's loud as heck out there. I'm sitting facing the sun, so I've got my sunglasses on. It's the worst possible environment to do a job interview in. So, I blame that, but I ended up going to another Nintendo event. I'm trying to remember, it was the Nintendo Fusion Tour.
Oh, yeah.
Kicked off in Seattle.
Yeah, and did I got you catch to go some of that Fall Out Boy or one of those other hot bands of the time?
It was Evanescence.
Oh, yes.
Heard and ended up being a very, very big fan.
Yeah, you're a big fan of those guys.
Yeah, big fan of Evanescence. Finger 11 was there. It was kind of a cool thing. And that wasn't really my style of music at the time, and I ended up, you know, really appreciating it and enjoying it, and you know, became more of it. And it turns out my wife now, it was a big fan of Evanescence too. So it was something that we were able to talk about. So it was kind of cool. But at that event, as we were leaving to go to the after party, I was walking down the street with some folks that it turned out worked at Nintendo, and, you know, struck up a conversation to them because that's what you do. And turned out that one of the gals I was talking to got that job.
Cool.
Writing for Nintendo Power. So, you know, I was talking to her about how, you know, because we had both, you know, mentioned, hey, we just interviewed for this job. And she goes, oh, did you get it? And I'm like, no, I didn't. I was like the second choice. And she goes, what job was it? And I told her, and she goes, oh. And I'm like, well, what's that look for? And she goes, well, that's the job I just started. that was kind of weird and awkward and kind of awesome all at the same time.
How did your kind of relationship to all this stuff end up sort of dissipating?
It's a good question. So I believe at the time, I'm trying to make sure I've got my timeline right.
I want to say about 2005 was when you really kind of walked away.
Yeah, 2005, I had just graduated from Cascadia that summer, or late spring, I guess. And, you know, really needed to be kind of getting back to work. And I think that if I got my dates right, I think I had actually started an internship not too long after that, with a marketing company here in the east side of Seattle. And I was basically going to be going to school full time to complete my bachelor's degree. I was going to be working full time at this internship on top of that. Plus I had, you know, a wife and a dog at home and stuff like that. And there just was not going to be any time left for really anything else. And, you know, I don't mind saying, because it's all kind of, you know, water under the bridge now, but it took a huge toll on my marriage as well. And we ended up getting divorced, I think, to that April. I think we separated April of 2007 and were divorced by that December. So it was just before and just after I graduated from the University of Washington that that ended. So, but yeah, it was, you know, I think if I had tried to pile, you know, writing for Planet GameCube, or I guess it was probably Nintendo World Report by then, on top of that, I think it was going to be a problem. And I think this was, I want to say, cause we had just switched over to Nintendo World Report. I think it was shortly after that, that I ended up leaving. But it had nothing to do with, you know, how I felt about the site. I still loved it a lot. I loved writing. I loved having that outlet for my thoughts and opinions and that sort of thing. I really liked that aspect of it, but I could not see how I was going to balance that with everything else that I had kind of going on at the time.
Yeah, it can be a pretty major commitment in your life to be really active in something like this. And I think you're someone who would have a hard time keeping a low level of involvement.
Yeah, and again, this it was something that I felt that, you know, I really belonged to, and I wanted to be able to contribute at a high level, have influence over the direction, that sort of thing. And I just didn't see it being something that I was going to be able to do part-time. I mean, it really was, I'm the kind of person that I've always got, you know, multiple things going on at the same time. You know, I've always got a full-time job, and then there's something else that I'm pouring a lot of effort into. Mm-hmm. You know, now it's my family, but, you know, back then it was, you know, it was that and whatever job I was doing and that sort of thing. I was able to kind of make it work when I was going to community college because, you know, community college wasn't that strenuous, which I think is maybe a terrible thing to say about my school, but it wasn't. But, you know, going for my bachelor's degree at a, you know, a big university, that was a whole different issue. I felt like it was probably a good transition point at that point to kind of make my exit. And yeah.
Fair enough. You mentioned having a family now, and I keep up with you online, so I've seen them, and I'm really, really happy for you that everything has worked out for you in that way. And I'm just curious, you know, now that you have a daughter, how do you think, well, and actually with your wife now too, how would you approach telling them about this stuff before? I mean, have you ever talked about it a lot with your new wife, and do you think it's something that you would get into with your daughter one day?
That's a good question. So, I haven't talked to them a lot. I mean, my wife knows that I've, you know, used to write for a lot of different places, you know, that sort of thing. We haven't really talked about it in depth. I mean, it was so long ago, from that kind of perspective that it just kind of seems almost like part of an old life that I had. And, you know, mm-hmm. I've got, you know, kind of a new one now. So I don't know that that's necessarily anything I would have, you know, bring up with them. And, you know, as far as my daughter's concerned, by the time she's old enough, maybe the internet's gonna be completely replaced with, you know, something like the Oasis from Ready Player One. I don't know. I've actually been, this is the kind of the perspective that I've had on a lot of the stuff, is that there's so much technology that we have now that she will completely take for granted.
Right. Yeah.
And there may be things that she ends up having that we aren't even necessarily imagining yet, or at least aren't commonplace. And, you know, I've got PlayStation's VR headset on pre-order, so I'm waiting for that to show up, and that'll be amazing. Mm-hmm. But again, she'll grow up, and by the time she's 10 years old, because she's like one now, by the time she's 10 years old, we'll be two or three generations into that, to the point where it's going to be, I think VR is probably going to become a dominant form of entertainment. And it's going to be something that she'll have grown up with. It'll just be part of the fabric of her life, and that's amazing to me. So I don't know that I'd necessarily, I don't know that kids necessarily care that much about the past of things that aren't necessarily historical, you know, in terms of significance. So I don't know that the, you know, a website kind of in the early days of the internet is necessarily going to interest her that much, especially if the internet isn't even a thing when she gets older. I mean, it's going to blow her mind when I tell her that I'm older than the internet. Yeah, that's going to be something she won't be able to wrap her head around.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what about it? What about as part of your past, you know, as something that was formative for you, something that had a lot of meaning for you before she was there? Is that something that you would consider, you know, cracking open and getting into one day?
If she were to ask, like maybe she's doing a school project or something and wants to know more about, you know, me when I was growing up or something like that, maybe. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't see any reason to necessarily bring it up with her. I'm not just going to, hey, let daddy talk to you about the olden days. Sorry, I don't see that happening. But honestly, I'm the kind of person that, you know, while I appreciate where I came from and all of our decisions and everything that happens to us, good or bad, is all getting us to where we are now, right? I prefer to look forward rather than analyze that stuff too much, because it's very easy to kind of look back and have regrets or have negative feelings about those sorts of things and let it color your perceptions of now. And that's, I think it's kind of an unfair thing to do to yourself. To the point where I was almost reticent about doing this, and I'm honestly doing it as a favor to you.
But it's
as I have looked back over everything that's happened, everything was just kind of a stepping stone to get me to where I am today. Even the bad stuff that happened, I would not be with my wife and my gorgeous little daughter if it hadn't been for a failed marriage, right? Mm-hmm. So I have a hard time looking at that as a negative thing when it's gotten me to this amazing place that I am now. You know, all the jobs and, you know, the jobs that I've lost and the jobs that I really loved that went away for whatever reason. All of those things, again, just kind of got me to where I am now in a career that I really love. So, I can't look back on any of that with any real negative sentiment at all. It's not fair to do that. So,
I think that's great.
Yeah. Did we ever close the loop on the Silicon Knights stuff that we were talking about? Did you want to get into that anymore? Bounced off that topic pretty fast.
I'm not sure exactly what closing the loop means, and that makes me wonder if there's a story here that I don't really know or don't remember very well. So, yeah, let's do that.
I guess only to say that that interview was a lot of fun. I was able to just kind of go in there. I had some questions jotted down, but I literally turned on the tape recorder, and I basically used the opportunity to ask him some questions that we wanted to know, to ask about the game industry, to ask him about the development process, because I had some background in that at that point. So I felt like I could speak intelligently with somebody about it. And
that is something that Dennis Dyack is really passionate about. Yes. I mean, really the world knows now, but back then you could just kind of, it was just oozing out of him.
Yeah, absolutely. And he loved being able to talk about that. And it was one of the safe things for him to talk about. There's always a PR person from Nintendo's firm at the time, which is Golan Harris. I don't know if they still are now, but at the time, there's always a PR person there watching and making sure that he doesn't say anything he's not supposed to. Sometimes he would glance over and see if he could get the okay before he'd say something. So being able to talk about process and that sort of thing was a lot easier for him to do, and it really got him to open up, so that when I would ask some of the other questions later and he was able to get the okay, he was a lot more forthcoming with us. And I think that was, I'm so happy that I had that background and was able to do that, because I don't know that a lot of folks at other outlets have necessarily the same background, were able to establish that same sort of rapport. I think it really helped us out a lot. And again, because of the outcome of that, because of how well it was received, not only by Dennis, but by Golan Harris and by our readership, I think that really helped kind of put our relationship with Nintendo on a much better note than maybe it had been. And it gave us a lot more opportunities down the road.
Yeah, we ended up interviewing Dennis many times after that, including, I remember, I'm pretty sure you were there when we sat around a little bitty table at E3 a couple years later in 2003 and talked with him about Metal Gear Solid.
Yeah, there was that one, and I seem to remember we also had a chat with him where we were outside. We went out the back door of the convention center, and we're out in this alley talking with him about stuff. But
absolutely.
Yeah, it was, we didn't know when we had first established that relationship with him that he was going to be working on a project of that prominence, of that much importance. Mm-hmm. And it just goes to show you that whenever you're in a situation where you're interviewing a developer, no matter how small or insignificant you may think that property happens to be or who that developer is, you need to treat those relationships as exactly that, as establishing relationships, because you never know where they're going to end up or where you're going to run into that person again. And those relationships carry over for years and years and end up giving you more opportunities even further down the road.
Yeah, of course. I completely agree. I mean, you, I'm sure, have kept up somewhat with what's happened with Dennis over the years. He's become really a pariah for the industry in a lot of ways. And I mean, part of that is he's made a couple of bad games. So I think he bears, and he's said some fairly inflammatory things that a lot of people didn't care for. But I'm just curious, if you have any particular feelings about that, and if you've kept in touch with him at all.
Yeah, that's a good question. So, so first of all, I don't know that he's necessarily a pariah for the game industry. I think they, you know,
Well, he is on NeoGAF.
Yeah, well, that's NeoGAF. Again, remember we talked about how the community can be pretty incendiary sometimes, just even with minimal provocation. So, you know, it is what it is. But I would say that Dennis has always had a very, very strong personality. He's got a definite idea of what he wants his things to be. He is very much an artist, and artists can be hard to understand sometimes, and it's not always easy for an artist to have their vision come out the way that they see it in their head. And I think with any of his games that he's made, he's always had an idea in his head of what something would be, and I think even he would say that, you know, whatever the finished product is, isn't always representative of that. I honestly liked Too Human. I thought it was actually a pretty good game. I thought it didn't meet its potential. I thought it could have been a really amazing sort of thing. I think it could have been almost a pseudo RPG, kind of an action RPG when that wasn't really in vogue at the time. So I think he was kind of nibbling around the edges of something that could have been really amazing.
Yeah. He was going for a Diablo kind of thing with a different sort of presentation. And I don't know how much of that really came through in the final game.
Yeah. And I liked the kind of, you know, kind of almost cyberpunk take on Norse mythology. I mean, I thought that was kind of, I thought it was inventive. I don't know that it's necessarily an original take, but I thought their version of it was definitely something I would have wanted to see more of. I was really hoping that Too Human was going to end up coming out with a number two human, the second version at some point. But
that was definitely planned.
Yeah, and unfortunately with, you know, Microsoft was, of course, going through this period at the time where they really didn't know kind of what all they were doing with their consoles, and Microsoft has a lot of political kind of machinations behind the scenes, and it's very, very difficult to develop for that platform, as you know, a lot of developers have found out. There's a lot of the, you know, political stuff you got to work for, and especially as you're a second party to Microsoft, it gets worse because there's a lot more people that you need to run things by, and it's hard to get anything done. I think Dennis would probably say something similar if you were to ask him. So it's kind of a hard relationship to have.
Yeah, well, I'm sure looking back, he greatly preferred working with Nintendo compared to Microsoft.
and that's saying
something. I don't even have to ask him about that. Yeah. I'm pretty damn sure he would say that.
And that's saying something, because Nintendo, especially as a second party, can be notoriously hard to work with. And I think, you know, I'm going to give a plug to an old friend here, but I think a lot of the credit for how well Eternal Darkness turned out, and, you know, to a lesser degree, I think Metal Gear Solid even, really comes down to the people that Nintendo had working with Dennis and Silicon Knights, and specifically Jeff Callis.
Yeah.
I think he was incredibly talented. I'm not a bit surprised, knowing Jeff Moore now, that things turned out that way. And I think when Jeff left and went to Penny Arcade, it was a huge boon for Penny Arcade and a massive loss to Nintendo.
And he's still there. He's been there a long time now, probably 10 years.
He's outlasted Robert Koo, which...
Right. It's amazing.
I really can't believe that. Robert Koo turned Penny Arcade into what it is. And finding out that he was leaving was probably as shocking as anything I've heard out of the game industry. And I've heard a lot.
Yeah, I could see that. But, I mean, just someone that talented, what's more impressive is that he was able to stay involved for that long after turning it into such a success.
Well, the only reason why I mentioned that, being shocked about that, is because Penny Arcade was really... they're very much a family. When they hire people on and they have people working for them, those people become family to them because they all spend so much time there. And Robert had been around for, I mean, basically was employee three. I mean, when it comes right down to it, after, you know, Mike and Jerry, it was Robert. And then Robert basically helped them build Penny Arcade into what it is. So finding that, you know, it's almost like saying that, you know, the patriarch of the family is going to be leaving. I mean, it's really kind of was on that level to me.
So. Well, and most definitely the grown up in the leadership, you know.
Yeah.
But I'm sure he wouldn't. He felt that things had stabilized. You know, that he had sort of created something that could stand on its own without him. And that's, you know, as someone who's a leader, you know, you and I have been in these positions as well. But that's really. That's all you could ask for is I created something, I put my stamp on it, I helped other people learn to do it also, and showed them the way I would expect it to be done and what I value in it. and I've made it strong enough that I can walk away,
Yep. And
and feel good that it will continue on. It'll become something new. It'll remain something that I care about, and that I support. And that's just building a legacy. So, you
yeah.
know, I guess I'm shifting away from Penny Arcade a little bit and talking about this, but that's something that I've tried to do, and I think you've done that too in your involvement with the website.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I'll just say that the I have no insider knowledge on this whatsoever, but I suspect that part of that decision is probably that you know, they put on a lot of events now. And I suspect that event management ended up becoming probably a good, you know, 80 to 90% of his job. I mean, they're doing events practically year round now. And with the, you know, the kind of the clip that they're going at, I suspect he's not doing as much of the stuff that he would want to do, but the fact of the matter is those events need to happen now. It's you know, a machine practically that you can't shut down quite so easily, and
And
nor should he,
that is very
you know.
much their business as well.
Yeah,
That's kind
it
of
is.
become the heart of their business in a lot of ways. And
Yeah,
by
it
the way,
really
Jeff
is.
Callis, you know, our friend who used to work at Nintendo of America and help produce games like Eternal Darkness and Geist and lots of other ones,
Oh, guys.
he is heavily involved in that event management as well, and is
Yes.
in some ways kind of the father of PAX and of all the PAXes. But yeah, Jeff's a guy that we've gotten a chance to talk to a number of times over the years during the telethons and whatnot, and he's a really good guy. So, Rob, I feel like we probably need to wrap up here.
Yeah, no worries.
Before we do, this is something I'm trying to do for everybody, but I just wanted to offer you the opportunity. If there was anything from the old days that you were curious about or wanted, you know, more information, if there's anything you wanted to ask me, this is a fine opportunity to do it, and it might help me remember something that I'm eventually going to want to write about in the book.
Oh, wow, that's a good question. I really don't know that there is. Like I said, I tend to be more of a forward-thinking sort of person. So the whole idea of kind of looking back and analyzing things that have happened in the past is kind of weird for me.
Yeah,
But
it's a lot
yeah.
of what I do.
Yeah,
That's,
yeah, yeah.
it's something I have to kind of have to wrestle with a lot with with something like this book.
I think probably the last thing that I'll say, and I'll, you know, I think this is kind of a good thing for you to chime in on, is I'd say probably the I said earlier there was three things I was really proud of. Maybe there's four because I just remembered this one and I wanted to bring it up, is finding Dan Bloodworth. Dan was a very, very vocal member of our forum community. Was a really, really good guy, and we kind of took a chance on him to give him a little bit of authority in the forums and allowing him to be kind of effectively become a community manager. And he did a fantastic job on it. And when the opportunity came around to add to our ranks and find somebody who would you know, be a full-time writer, we offered it to him. And I can't imagine us having found somebody better than Dan at that period. He was really amazing. And you know, the fact that out of all of us, he was really the first one to end up, you know, kind of quote unquote breaking into the game industry and kind of getting a permanent role there is not at all surprising to me.
Well, I
But
mean,
that
after Billy. Yeah, no, I agree with you, and you know, I think one of the best things about being in the leadership of the website, which is something that you and I did together for quite a while. One of my favorite things about it was finding these people who, you know, who were really passionate and really talented, and bringing them into the fold and sort of giving them just enough training or, you know, imparting enough knowledge from your own experiences to get them going and to help them understand how the site, you know, some of the things that have to be done and have to be done in a certain way, but also bringing in their unique voices and helping them to contribute to it and help evolve what the website can do and what it means to people. And especially the energy of people like that, you know, people who are often younger and less experienced, but very passionate, bringing them into the organization and letting them sort of ignite other people, including ourselves. That was always really exciting to me because it made me want to do better at what I was doing. You know, when I saw someone like that who really there's just no limit on what he's capable of. That's very inspiring to the people the grizzled old Jedis as well, who are sitting
Absolutely.
Around wondering, why am I still doing all this?
Yeah, it's being able to recognize potential in people that maybe those people don't even know is there, and finding ways to help them reach that potential, and then sometimes even surpass it, is real. I mean, that's really the best gift that we can offer them in a situation where people don't get paid to write for a site like this, right? So being able to give them that opportunity and watching people take the most of it and being able to kind of mentor them and lead them in those ways is it's definitely a privilege, and it's one that I'm really proud to say we did a great job at, I think.
Yeah, in most cases I think we did.
Yep.
Many mistakes were made along the way, but yeah, overall I feel pretty good about that. Rob, I thank you for your time. I think we've covered a lot of ground actually in a relatively short interview here. So, you know, I think that's just a testament to your ability to talk about all this stuff. I feel like, you know, we should close on some kind of thought, and maybe it's just a chance for you to talk a little bit about video games, because you are still an active player, and I know you're playing The Witcher 3 now, and you talked about, you know, PlayStation VR, which I'm excited about too. But being that one of your numerous of your classic articles involve Zelda, and you gave the Legend of Zelda: The Wind Waker a 10 out of 10 on our site back in 2003. Have you been able to keep up with the new Zelda, the Breath of the Wild, and you know, do you have any thoughts about that? Is that tempting for you to come back into Nintendo in some way?
I will say that seeing that game, and it's made me actually debate getting a Nintendo console again. I had the Wii, I barely played the Wii at all. You know, pretty much everybody played Wii Sports. I think I had a couple other games for it, and that was, you know, Super Mario. Was it Mario Sunshine? I'm trying to remember which one came out for the Wii.
Oh, Galaxy.
Galaxy, there we go. I like Galaxy. I never played Galaxy 2. But, you know, I felt like the Nintendo was leaning a little bit too hard on gimmicks and not necessarily the quality of the games themselves. And I think that with other than a few rare exceptions, that continued. And even the Zelda games, I ended up, you know, I probably shouldn't say this out loud, I ended up firing up an emulator and playing, I think, Twilight Princess. And it was okay. I mean, it wasn't, you know, the best Zelda game I'd ever played. I thought it was all right. I don't think I ever played Skyward Sword, or if I did, I played very little of it. But this, seeing this one, I think Nintendo has finally realized that, you know, gimmicks like the Wii U gamepad and things like that don't replace, you know, actual, you know, quality in terms of, you know, the kind of game mechanics and stuff like that. You can't lean on that crutch too much.
Yeah.
Seeing what they've come up with, especially since they've effectively removed the gamepad functionality from the game. And
yeah,
really...
or at least from the E3 demo, I'm wondering if that some of that might creep back in.
It's hard to say. They may want to, just to make sure that it sells at all on Wii U. But the rumor is NX won't have any sort of a gimmick like that. It's going to be more of kind of a traditional console, maybe not as powerful as we'd like, but, you know, it's going to be a little bit more in that kind of vein. In order to make sure that there's parity between the two games, they would end up making the NX version kind of lesser than the Wii U version. So I wouldn't be a bit surprised to see them stick with using the gamepad just maybe for a second screen functionality or something along those lines. But it's actually got me considering the NX, where I have not considered the Wii U at all, which would make the Wii U the first Nintendo game console I have not owned.
Well, you haven't owned it so far. I'd say now is probably not the best time to jump into the Wii U.
Nope. I'm thinking that's pretty well done at this point. So
yeah.
What's funny is Nintendo is now doing the same thing with Breath of the Wild that they did with Twilight Princess. And I don't know how successful, if at all, that strategy was for them last time.
Oh, you mean splitting it across two generations?
Splitting across two console generations.
Yeah. Well, it did. I mean, Twilight Princess is one of the best-selling Zelda games. I mean, in large part because it was a launch title for the Wii, which is the most successful video game system of all time.
Yep. But I think Wii U probably hurt them big. So yeah. It'll be interesting to see how many people are willing to do that with NX. Because again, we had an amazing gimmick, and it did an amazing job of getting people that did not consider themselves gamers to play things, even if all they played was Wii Sports. You know, it was a very accessible console in that regard. So I think that helped. I don't know that NX is going to have that same thing going for it. So it'll be interesting to see if the same strategy pays off this time. Yeah. But I know Nintendo is going through a lot of transitions that I would not, you know, ever wish on anybody, you know, with the loss of their CEO and whatnot. So I don't know. They're going to be an interesting company to watch going forward for sure.
They always are in one way or another, aren't they?
Yeah.
But I think on that editorial, I can't think of a better way to close out the interview. And it's pretty clear to me, Rob, that you still got a lot to say after all these years. So thanks for...
I don't have as much of an outlet anymore. So yeah. Since it got all bottled up, and I got to unload them on somebody. So.
Yeah. Well, there's always an open invitation. I'll just speak for myself, and to the degree I can promise that. Other than this interview, I think we'd always love to have a guest article or something if you ever have time to put something together.
Well, I hear there's a new Nintendo console coming soon. And
indeed.
Maybe Rick Powers will have something to say.
All right, man. Thanks a lot, and good luck with everything, and especially with your new family.
Thanks, Johnny. Talk to you again soon.
All right, buddy. See ya.
Bye.